Well, since the beginning of time, mankind has tried to mesh science with spirituality. And where has it gotten us? In a moment, Sacred Pathways. I'll be talking with Todd Murphy. As a matter of fact, I talked with him back in 2007, long time ago. But he's back, and I will be too on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Todd Murphy is a professor. He is a professor of behavior neurosciences. He has published in the Journal for Near-Death Studies, Psychology Reports, the journal, other scientific journals as well. He is the author of Sacred Pathways, The Brain's Role in Religious and Mystic Experiences. I want you to sit back and enjoy this interview because, well, it depends on how you view science and spirituality. Let's welcome back. After how long has it been? 7 years, Todd?
Yeah, just about. Wow. Little more than 7 years.
Well, see, we gave you enough time to write Sacred Pathways and to come back on.
You did indeed, and I appreciated the break.
How have you been, Todd? Everything good?
Well, a lot has changed, of course. Some things have changed in my life. I am, unfortunately, I have seven years worth of gray hairs since we last spoke.
That happens.
My daughter has come of age, and, well, there's been a lot of interesting and exciting things happening, some struggles, some victories, and, well, here we are in the present moment.
And you continue to fight the good fight.
I continue to labor the good labor. Let's leave the fighting to other people.
When we last left you 7 years ago, what were you doing then?
At that time, I was developing some of the theories and hypotheses that are now in the book. I was working on neurotechnology. I have at that time, I had the Shakti neural stimulation device, which has elicited some religious experiences, some meditation transformations and enhancements, mood enhancements, and things like that. And that's been in continual development. In 2008, I developed the Shiva neural stimulation system, which emulates Dr. Michael Persinger's octopus apparatus. And that's the one that elicited some telepathic communication between brains in the laboratory. It also enhanced remote viewing in a couple of well-known remote viewers, Ingo Swann and Sean Harabans.
Uh-huh.
And then in 2010, I was able to adapt the system in order to duplicate Persinger's God helmet. And, of course, that's a very well-known technology, quite controversial. People crawl out of the woodwork to find arguments to throw at it. Most of them rather flimsy, in my view. And there's been some recent evidence from an independent research group that it's not just a trick of the mind or suggestion or anything like that, that it really is for real. But we can get into some of that later on in the interview.
Yeah.
But I would say the palladium of my work has been the issuing of Volume 1, Sacred Pathways, The Brain's Role in Religious and Mystic Experiences, which your listeners can find at spiritualbrain.com. So there's been quite a lot.
There is a lot. Now, when we try to bridge this gap between science and spirituality, what do we come up with? Do we come up with similar things going down different pathways, basically, as you point out?
Well, when we try to bridge the gap between science and spirituality, a lot depends on the approach that the individual researcher, the worker, the intellectual takes in trying to make the connection between the two. Most of the history's efforts to unite science and religion have been based on a person's taking a religious belief and then looking for scientific validation of that belief. And usually that doesn't work out too well. In the 15th century, Johannes Kepler, the one who came up with Kepler's laws of planetary motion, and those are still taught in colleges today, he was trying to take the Platonic theory of solids, so that there were certain shapes that were intrinsically perfect, like the square, the circle, the dodecahedron, and so forth, and trying to align them up with planetary motions and the paths of the planets through the heavens. And he kept trying and trying and trying, and in the end, it simply didn't work. There was Emanuel Swedenborg, a man who had personal revelations, and he was shown some truths and tried to use the science of his time to prove that it was right. So if you take, and then there are today's creationists, let's not leave them out. They start with absolute faith in the Bible, in the book of Genesis, where it says God created the world in 7 days and created Adam and Eve in 2 of those days, if I'm remembering my scripture correctly. And there's a great deal of work been done trying to prove that the world was created the way the Bible said it was. In the 18th century, there was a famous bishop, Archbishop Usher, who calculated according to the begats, you know, where so-and-so begat so-and-so, mm-hmm. and so-and-so begat Methuselah, who lived for 1,000 years, who begat so-and-so, and working with all of the points of reference in the Bible, calculated that the world was created in 4004 B.C., October 23rd, and it was a Wednesday. Now, this kind of approach to marrying science and religion never works, and the reason is simple. The fundamental rule of religion, at least in Western religion, is faith. So you take a statement from the Bible, from the Book of Mormon, from the Torah, and then you do the work that you need to do to try and prove that it's correct. And my starting point is quite different. I start with the rules of science and the contemporary theories that science accepts. If I have to spin out some kind of elaborate, special, new, radical theory in order to base a merger of science and religion, the scientific community is never going to listen. And if they're not listening, then for all intents and purposes, no one is listening. So for me, the beginning point in the integration of science and religion is Darwin's theory. If you can't accept Darwin's theory, any science, and you're talking about human behavior or biology or evolution in any other sense, if you don't agree with Darwin, you're not doing science. So for me, it begins with the notion that all scriptural bases for any kind of scientific investigation in spirituality have to be thrown away. You can't start with anyone's scripture. You can't take scripture as evidence of any kind. Now, what I found in my work is that in developing some of my hypotheses and some of my ideas, I found that many of the traditional religious teachings are valid. They're validated by what I'm doing and what I'm finding.
Is that surprising to you?
Not really. And the reason is I'm getting a little ahead of myself here. The reason is that our capacity for spirituality, in my view, is based on our evolutionary history. We believe in God because we're evolved to believe in God. We're evolved to believe in things that that motivate adaptive behavior, evolved to believe in things that make us feel good and reduce our stress level, which makes us more effective as people in relating to other people, in responding to threats, in taking advantage of opportunities. The less stressed we are, the clearer we think, and the better we act. So there are many things that people believe that are not true, but believing in them encourages them to act in ways that help us survive. We don't believe in truth as a species. We believe in things that help us perform well with other people and in the nature, the sometimes threatening nature that surrounds us. So the beginning point is Darwin's theory. That puts us in the scientific community. Now, in the course of my work and in the book, again, spiritualbrain.com, I do make some assumptions. I come up with what are called axioms or postulates. These are things that we begin a line of reasoning assuming are true. And if you can't accept the assumption, then nothing that's built on it's going to make any sense. Nothing that's built on it will be agreeable. Assumptions, postulates, and axioms are part of the scientific method. If you don't like assumptions, and there's a common adage that you shouldn't make you shouldn't assume because to assume makes an ass of you and me. Ha ha ha! Clever play on words.
Remember that one.
Yes, but all of science is based on assumptions. after the theory that's built on the assumption gets a certain amount of validation and verification, then we take the assumptions as true, even though they may not be proven. If you go back to your basic, elementary school textbook of geometry, they'll tell you something like a point is a location in space with no dimensions. And of course, the intelligent kids say, how can this exist? A line is a path between two such points, and it has no thickness at all. And of course, there is no such thing. But if you allow the assumptions to work in your mind, then the whole world of plane geometry, the geometry of flat surfaces, makes an incredible amount of sense. And you can use it to guide architecture and build buildings, and the buildings stand up. You can navigate from one place to another correctly, even though you're doing it based on nonsensical assumptions. You're trying to go from L.A. to New York City. New York City is a point. L.A. is a point. Neither of them have any dimensions. And the path between the two has no thickness. It's ridiculous. But if you accept it as true and turn on the GPS without getting stuck there, then you end up in New York City.
Todd, if I remember 7 years ago,
okay.
Weren't you an atheist then?
I remain an atheist.
You still are?
Yes.
Okay.
But I'm an atheist who believes in God. I'm an atheist who prays.
You've got to explain that.
Okay. Well, my favorite quotation on this subject, which I quote in my book, as well as I believe our interview some years ago, is from Candace Pert.
I'm losing you on the phone a little bit there.
I'm sorry.
There you go.
Candace Pert was the discoverer of the opiate receptors in the brain. I believe she either got a Nobel or was nominated for a Nobel for that. It was very important work. It was the first time that anyone had been able to find a specific receptor in the brain for a specific chemical. And in its day, that was a landmark piece of work. And some journalists went to see her. They wrote The 3-Pound Universe. Hooper and Terese are the authors. And they had an interview with her, and they said, do you believe in God? And she said, yes, I believe in God. I'm a member of a species that believes in God. So how could I not believe? Her argument in favor of a belief in God was not based on God's existence or non-existence. It was a recognition that belief in God is intrinsic to our species. Its truth or falsehood has nothing to do with it. So I find prayer to be a fulfilling practice. Actually, just recently, a friend of mine kind of challenged me to say the rosary because I was raised Catholic. And I said, okay, why not? And I took the rosary, and I said the ritual prayers that I learned when I was very young. And I found that while I was doing it, there was a kind of a sense of something spiritual that came back to me that I hadn't experienced since I was quite young. And that felt good. The actual mechanism of prayer, the effectiveness of prayer, the belief in God, the Father, whose Son is Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. the existence of the Virgin Mary had absolutely nothing to do with how it felt to return to the spiritual practice of my youth. It felt good. So I say to myself, do I want to live a life that is filled with truth, or do I want to live a life that's filled with feeling good? The answer is a no-brainer, literally, because I can't use my brain to decide. I have to feel what I feel. I have to use my heart, so to speak, metaphorically, and come up with my answer there. It feels good, so do it. It has the atheist who tells you that you should only believe in things that are true, because otherwise you will have, and I'll give you a favorite atheist phrase, cognitive dissonance, simply doesn't understand the point. The difference between you, what you believe and what you find to be true may make some cognitive dissonance. But the atheist is going to have the same cognitive dissonance as they see the difference between the life they want and the one they've got.
You may be the only atheist who believes. There are not many.
Well, there are a few. One of them comes to mind in particular. He's a very old man now, but I've known him for a long time. And I asked him about his religion and his spirituality because his home was filled with religious art. And I said, you're an atheist, but this is, you know, you have a large painting of the Virgin Mary and look at this gorgeous Orthodox crucifix. And he said, oh, yeah, I don't believe in any of it, but I love this. It's so beautiful. I mean, just look at it. It's magnificent. And the vibe, the mood that comes off of this artwork, you're not going to find anywhere else. And I had to admit that he was right. The religious ethos, as expressed in art and music and the pomp and splendor of a well-performed ceremony, you're simply not going to find anywhere else. So I said, if you don't believe in God, but you're so deep into your religious life, what do you actually believe? And he said, you want to know what I believe? What does it for me? I love opera. And when the soprano sings the high note, and I have to say, ah, how beautiful. And my hands fold naturally over my chest as my head rolls back and a chill runs through my body. That is the center of my real religion. So this man's religion was the appreciation of beauty. His religion was aesthetics.
Your subtitle, The Brain's Role, tells me that a lot of this could be, based on your assumptions, could be biological, could be physical.
I agree. But the idea that it's biological immediately implies that it somehow comes from our evolutionary history.
Right.
And then it's not an assumption anymore. One of the operating assumptions of evolutionary psychology, evolutionary biology, evolutionary anthropology, is that all human behaviors that are found in all cultures are the result of our evolutionary history. There are a couple of exceptions. I have a book over to my left here, waiting for me to read a quotation, because there's a point, and I'm sure we'll get to. But yes, we believe, because our biology, literally the architecture of our brains, encourages us to believe the very same neural skills and functions and pathways that operate when we're relating to another person also operate when we're relating to God, whether God exists in our brains or in the universe at large. We are evolved to relate to other beings.
How do we know that there's something beyond the brain?
Well, my answer to that needs to be, we don't know. But what I will suggest, and this is actually laid out in the introduction to my book, again, you can find it at spiritualbrain.com, is that what the scientific community needs to do is assume that mind and heart, in the poetic use of the word, like the heart chakra, that everything that we experience comes from our brain. So we take that down. We take that on a breakdown voyage. Now, a breakdown voyage in the Navy refers to the first launch of a ship, and there are special crews that go on the boat, breakdown crews, and they take the boat out and they take it through storms. They run it onto rocks. They pump the engine up to the absolute maximum. They turn on a dime if the ship will manage it, which, of course, they never do. But they put it through some really rough testing. And what they're doing is looking for anything that doesn't work or doesn't work the way it should. The Navy, which has the lives of its crewmen at stake on those same boats, is not willing to take 150 tests for 150 parts and say, you know, they've all been tested individually, so the boat is good to go. They say, no, we're going to take the boat out, all assembled as one unit, and we're going to do everything we can to make it fail. So the scientific community should assume that mind is nothing but brain and push that belief as far as they can. And when that belief breaks down, that is where we will find the point where mind is more than brain, where some kind of spirit that has no physical basis actually informs our consciousness and helps us to be aware and to be cognizant of what I consider to be the greatest miracle of all, and that is that anything exists at all.
Todd, we're going to come back with you in just a moment. on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about sacred pathways. Take your phone calls next hour with Todd Murphy as we talk about his work, Sacred Pathways. We shall be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Todd Murphy back with us here on Coast to Coast. Todd, what about near-death experiences? How do they fit into this equation?
Well, I think that near-death experiences are, again, part of our evolutionary heritage, and this is where I get a little radical. Near-death experiences function in the death process, and I believe the death process is part and parcel of, and now all the people who can pull out their woo-woo rubber stamps and rubber stamp me if they want, reincarnation. Hmm. And what near-death experiences are is a long process, sometimes a very short process, but it's quite involved, and it involves multiple experiences. In Western countries, and Eastern ones are quite different, you go out of your body, you sometimes look down at your body, you enter a tunnel or an infinite void, then you go to the end of the tunnel where there is a light, or through that void to a point of light. You enter the point of light. Then you are in the. Then you feel tremendous bliss. Sometimes the bliss starts earlier, but you feel this tremendous bliss. Then you meet what researchers call the being of light, and then you review your life. And what I think is happening is that the near-death experience overall prepares people for this life review. And in the life review, we re-experience our behaviors or our life flashes before our eyes. In some cases, it seems to be shown symbolically. But what happens, I believe, is that we are evaluating our behavior. And the behaviors that we feel good about are tagged for repetition, or rather, the states of consciousness, the moods that inspired the behavior, are tagged for repetition or avoidance. So if your life flashes before your eyes, and in spite of its incredible speed, people still have distinct responses to individual things they see themselves doing during their lives. And if it's something you don't feel good about, then that's a behavior, a state of consciousness you want to avoid in your next life. If it's something you feel good about, that's something you want to do more of. And by tagging all the behaviors, or at least many of the behaviors, so for repetition or avoidance, what it does is it gives us a gut instinct in our next life that tells us how to behave, especially when relating to other people. And the sticking to the social rules, and the better able you are to live according to the rules, the better your chances for becoming an alpha male or an alpha female. If you're reborn, so to speak, with the capacity to become an alpha, a chief, a shaman, I'm talking about early in our evolutionary history, right. Forget today's structures, but you can become a chief, a shaman, a respected warrior, a voice that is listened to in the tribal councils, you get closer to the top of the ladder. And if you're a female, people want to curry favor with you and make you an alpha female that way. So what happens is that for males, the higher the social rank, the more mating opportunities they have, a thing that continues to this day. Rich men have trophy wives. Rich men are pursued by gold diggers. Some of them can be quite attractive. An unattractive gold digger is not, you know, a working proposition. But if you are rich and successful, or in our early evolutionary history, you were respected and successful, the more women would be available to you. Whether, you know, if you have, were in a monogamous culture.
That may be short-term, though, too, Todd, I think. Short-term
in terms of a man's life?
No, in terms of, you know, if he doesn't have character, for example, all the money in the world might not get him to the chosen pathway.
Well, in our early history, very few men without character got to be the chief. You see, our early evolutionary history included living in villages where everyone knew everyone. Your teepee, your hut, your yurt, your shelter was very close to everyone else's. So that if you had an argument with your wife,
everybody knew.
So the man who made good decisions and handled problems calmly would have been regarded as having a good character, and he would be the one who would be most likely to be chief.
Now most people don't even know their neighbors.
This leads me to a digression. Like American Indian reservations, it's been said that when the white people came, we shattered the Native Americans' lives. By the way, the Lakota religion with the sacred medicine pipe and the sweat lodge ceremony, the sun dance, is among my favorite religions. And because I'm an atheist, I get to pick and choose any way I want. If a religion is beautiful, I can take it on. But if you were an alpha female, it meant that people wanted to curry favor with you. They wanted to get on your good side. One of the best ways to do that would be to give her food. So in times of famine, or when the tribe was on the move and food was in short supply, which woman was least likely to see her kids go malnourished? The alpha female.
Huh, interesting.
And that would mean that her kids had a better chance of growing up and passing on their DNA. To a large extent, perhaps, winning the evolutionary game isn't having children, but rather having grandchildren, because you've got to see your children grow up and have kids of their own before you're on the top in evolutionary terms. So the life review in the near-death experience, which I take to be a real expression of the death process, prepares you to reach the top of the social ladder. In human culture, and this is the important point, human culture changes. So that if one generation, the rain is plentiful and the game is easy to find, the rules don't have to be very strict about some things. But in other times, like when there's drought and when there's famine, especially if it goes on more than one generation, the culture will change. So the rules will change. And that meant that past life information is a kind of flexible instinct. If it's hard-coded in our genes, the instinct won't change. And if the situation the instinct works with changes, you can go extinct. But if we have an instinct for culture, and cultures change, then the information derived from our past lives can change when we go through the life review. And this means, reincarnation pre-adapts us to live in a culture that is always a moving target. Without recourse to inflexible instincts, we are a species that changes. We went from many gods to one god in the West. That changed our culture. At one time, everybody owned practically everything. There's the Eskimo saying, quoted on the TV series The West Wing, that the best place to store your extra food is in your neighbor's stomach.
But it's true.
Yes, it is. And now we have private property. Not only is your salad yours in your refrigerator, and no one gets to mess with your salad without your say-so, but your land is your land, and your children are your children. If they're your responsibility, it takes the whole village to raise the child. But our laws, especially today in America, where we're so paranoid about having our children have contact with bad people that we actually exclude a lot of good people along the way, our children are almost our property. And that's a huge cultural change. So...
digressing a little bit from reincarnation, is it not?
Well, I believe that reincarnation functions to pre-adapt us to our cultural environments. So in this view, which is very different from the traditional Hindu, Buddhist, and for the benefit of a few listeners, Jaina religions, the Pacific Northwest Indians believed in reincarnation as well. Discussion of reincarnation from an evolutionary perspective instantly brings us to cultural anthropology. Cultural anthropology is the science that can unlock the reason why reincarnation exists, if it does exist. And I'm not so self-absorbed as a scientist to try and discount the opinions of those who believe there is no such thing.
Why doesn't most mainstream Christianity believers believe in reincarnation?
Because it is given to, I'm misquoting here, but I believe that it's New Testament. It is given to man to live but once, and after that, the judgment. And because of this one quotation from the Bible, your true Bible-believing, born-again, fundamentalist Christian will never consider reincarnation. Reincarnation, if I'm not mistaken, was examined at the Council of Isaac in 411 A.D., as well as the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D., and both of them rejected it. We do not come back. There were Gnostic Christians early in Christian history who did believe in reincarnation, or believed at least that it could be God's will that we reincarnate. This view was rejected very early in the history of Christianity, and ever since then, that's it. We live, we die, we stand before the Creator, and after that, it's heaven, oh joy, or hell, oh my God, you burn forever and ever, and your eyes are going to burn, and your toenails are going to burn, and your pubic hair is going to burn, and every part of you is going to burn, and let's scare the children with this.
So you don't believe in evil?
I believe in maladaptive states of consciousness, moods that inspire us to do things that we really shouldn't be doing. But that's different from evil. There are people whose minds are so filled with anger and hatred and aversion towards things and towards people, even people they only disagree with, that they're willing to set off bombs. Islam has gotten such a fundamentalist Islam, forgive me, to all the ordinary Muslims. Yes, they've got people to the point where they're not only willing to kill others, but willing to kill themselves in order to do it. And in most monotheistic traditions, suicide is an absolute sin. You do it, you go to hell, pure and simple. And yet you can override all of this and the instinct for self-preservation because you hate the other guy enough to do it. In fundamentalist Christianity, we find a few people that hate abortion clinics enough to set fire to them, to vandalize them, and to threaten the lives of the doctors and the nurses that work there. Any religion, any ideology that is based on hatred, and not all such ideologies are religious, is bound to create horrible abuses. Nazism in Germany was not a religious movement, and yet it was just its hatred towards the Jewish people. It's hard to find any parallel in religion, but it wasn't religion. It was a political ideology.
Exactly. And so they were brainwashed.
And they were brainwashed, yes. By the time the war was over and there were 12-year-old kids who'd never known anything but Nazism, they couldn't possibly imagine not hating Jews. Now it becomes the paradigm of evil, a rank hatred of a huge number of people without regard for the merits of anyone in it. If they're Jewish, they're bad. If they're Christians, if they're Hindus, they're bad. They're tools of the devil, this kind of thing. The Pope met with the Dalai Lama in the 80s. This is Pope John Paul II.
Who, by the way, wrote the foreword to your book, right? The Dalai Lama?
The Dalai Lama wrote a foreword to my book.
You're going to have to tell us how you pulled that off.
Well, I was on a fascinating digression, but you've brought me back to the point. There's a bishop who worked with Cambodian refugees in California. And I met him at a Cambodian cultural event. I like to dip my mind into many different cultures. And I met him there, and we became friends. And I had written an early draft of what is now the chapter on reincarnation. And he said, this is a completely different approach to reincarnation. And he presented it to the Cambodian patriarch, who has since died, Priya Mahagosananda, a magnificent soul if ever I've met one. And Priya Mahagosananda said, this has to go, take this to the Dalai Lama, and appointed him as an envoy to go see the Dalai Lama. So he did. He got a plane ticket, went to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama's office, and was ushered in immediately without any appointment. The Dalai Lama read it on the spot and said, yes, this is what we want. We want more science together with Buddhism, and we want it based, this is based on Darwin, and I've seen lots of science that connects with the Buddhist Dharma, the classical teachings, but this is the first thing I've seen that had Darwin in it. So you go back to the author and you tell him to keep working, and the word came back.
Good for you.
When the manuscript was finished, I approached the same fellow again, and he sent off a letter with a copy of the book to His Holiness. And after waiting some months for it to pass through committees to be decided whether it was worth His Holiness's time.
And read by about 20 people there, probably.
Yes, and I'm sure a three-fifths majority or better had to agree that it was worth telling the Dalai Lama that he should read it. And he did, and then came back an email with a scan of His Holiness's foreword to the book that's now framed and on my wall, thing I stand in front of for inspiration. And His Holiness said, after going over, His Holiness uses forewords to books as an opportunity to make points that are related to the contents of the book. So if he writes a foreword, usually, and I've only read maybe 5-6 of them, usually his comments about the book are in the last paragraph. And what he had to say here was that in this book, Professor Todd Murphy recounts what he has discovered about the brain's role in religious and mystic experiences, findings that interested readers will no doubt find illuminating. Now, His Holiness refers to my hypotheses, and that's basically what it is. It's a chain of hypotheses. He refers to them as discoveries, which is a compliment that I consider unworthy. I know that that an hypothesis comes below a theory, and a theory comes below a paradigm, a body of information that an entire scientific field works with. And when he said interested readers will find it illuminating, that was his way, I think, of saying that people who are interested in Buddhism and science should read this book, but without phrasing it so that it became a specific endorsement. He's a pontiff. His first loyalty has to be to the traditional teachings of the Buddha that he embodies in his life and in his work and everything he does. So he can't say anything so decisive that he encourages replacing the Buddha Dharma with my ideas.
But you struck a nerve with him.
Clearly so, and I can't tell you. I mean, I literally couldn't breathe for a good 30 seconds when the email came in, but there it was.
You pray a lot. Why?
My belief in the validity of prayer for everyone, and there's a chapter in the book on the subject.
And I agree with you, by the way. I agree with you wholeheartedly about prayer.
Well, in that case, I think you're right. I believe, in order to answer that question, I have to take a step back and talk about what happens in a human brain when someone is with God, whether they're the mystic on their knees on the mountaintop, arms upraised in rapture, with a literal vision of the creator of the universe, as they believe, in front of them, or whether it is someone who is simply praying and feels that they feel God's presence. And what I think is happening, and this is based on the work of Dr. Michael Persinger, who also wrote a foreword to the book. I'm a member of his university research group. But what I think is happening, what he thinks is happening, is that there are actually two senses of self in the human brain. One of them is on the left side, and the other is on the right side. Now, ordinarily, the left side one, the one that is on the side that has our language centers so that speech comes to us naturally and quickly whenever we need it. Being able to talk without groping for words is an essential social skill. No one gets to be the chief if they have to grope for every word. We meet someone who does that, we assume that there's some kind of deficit. Something's wrong with their brain, they have a psychological disorder or something like that. We are, in our normal moments, our linguistic self. On the other side of the brain, where there are no language centers, we are a silent self. And what I think is happening is that when we're experiencing God, an angel, a non-physical being, a demon, or we just have the feeling that there's someone behind us, but when we turn to look, there's no one there. It's called the sensed presence. When this is happening, the you that's on the left side of the brain and the you that's on the right side of the brain are not in communication the way they normally are. The communication is broken down, they've fallen out of phase, there's too much activity running between them, and the sense of self on the right side of the brain emerges into our awareness as a presence outside of ourselves.
Todd, hold on, we're going to come back, we're going to talk more about sacred pathways, and we'll take some phone calls with you in our final hour on Coast to Coast AM.